Hi everyone, this is Carrie, and this podcast is going to continue on with the Chronic Neurological Problems PowerPoint, starting with multiple sclerosis on slide 56. So multiple sclerosis is a chronic inflammatory autoimmune disorder that damages the myelin sheath of neurons in the CNS, causing a wide variety of sensory, motor, and cognitive deficits. Initially, most patients experience a period of acute clinical exacerbations, known as relapses, alternating with periods of complete or partial recovery, which is known as a remission. Over time, symptoms usually grow progressively worse, although the course of the disease is unpredictable and highly variable among patients. In the young adult population, multiple sclerosis causes more disability than any other neurological disease. Nonetheless, most patients manage to lead fairly normal lives, and life expectancy is only slightly reduced. MS affects about 400,000 people in the U.S. and 2.5 million people worldwide. It does tend to affect women more than men, two to three times more often than men. So, sorry, women, we seem to have these problems sometimes. Let's talk about the etiology and pathophysiology. The cause really is unknown for MS, but the pathologic hallmark sign of MS is the presence of multifocal regions of inflammation and myelin destruction in the CNS, in the brain, spinal cord, and the optic nerve. So because of demyelination, axonal conduction is slowed or blocked, therefore giving rise to a host of neurologic signs and symptoms. As the inflammation subsides, damaged tissue is replaced by astrocyte-derived filaments, therefore forming scars known as scleroses, therefore the name multiple sclerosis. It is important to note that, in addition to stripping off myelin, inflammation may injure the underlying axon and may also damage the oligodendrocytes, the cells that produce the CNS myelin. So axon injury can also occur in the absence of inflammation and can be seen early in the course of the disease. So how does this inflammation actually occur? The mechanism appears to be autoimmune. Cells of the immune system mistakenly identify components of myelin as being foreign and therefore mount an attack against them. For the attack to occur, circulating lymphocytes, or your T cells, and monocytes, which are your macrophages, must adhere to the endothelium of the CNS blood vessels, migrate across the vessel wall, and then initiate the inflammatory process. The end result is an inflammatory cascade that destroys the myelin and may also injure the axonal membrane and nearby oligodendrocytes. So what initiates this autoimmune response? Again, that cause is initially unknown. Its most likely candidates are our genetics, environmental factors, as well as microbial pathogens. Viruses, again, fall right into this category. The next slide actually shows a picture of what we just talked about, the pathogenesis of MS. A shows a normal nerve cell with the myelin sheath where it needs to be, and B shows a normal axon, whereas when we have C, we start to see some of that myelin breakdown, and D, we have the myelin totally disrupted and the axon therefore not functioning. So you can just see kind of how, as it's attacking the myelin and the actual axon itself, what happens and how that nerve transmission can be broken. Initially, the myelin sheath of the neurons in the brain and spinal cord are attacked, but the nerve fibers are not affected. But as that disease progresses, the nerve fibers then become detected, and the patient starts to have more noticeable impairment of function. If we look at the next slide, there's a picture of the brain that actually shows multiple sclerosis. The P actually shows a demyelination in plaque at the gray-white junction there. And it's kind of hard to see, especially on the PowerPoint, but if you look in your textbook, it shows a better picture of that. And also you can see partially remyelinated shadow plaque, and that's what the V is showing. I do want to just think about multiple sclerosis, and actually my question is, does it travel down to the peripheral neurons? So is it just centrally located in the brain, or does it go throughout the whole body? And the answer to that is actually no, it stays in the CNS. Myelin in the periphery is made by Schwann cells, whereas the myelin in the CNS, is made by your oligodendrocytes. Although the myelin produced by these two cell types is very similar, it is not identical. Because peripheral myelin differs somewhat from CNS myelin, the immune system does not identify peripheral myelin as foreign, and therefore it is spared. So we only see this degeneration of the myelin sheath within the central nervous system. So now let's talk about some signs and symptoms. What do we see? Again, generally it starts pretty vague, but and occurs intermittently over months and years. So it takes a while before we truly know or can diagnose MS. People with MS can experience a wide variety of signs and symptoms depending on where this demyelination occurs. A patient may experience some paresthesias, which includes numbness, tingling, feeling like they're on pins and needles. They may have muscle or motor problems, which can include weakness, clumsiness, ataxia, spasms, spasticity, tremors, or cramping. They could have visual impairment, including blurred vision, double vision, blindness, bladder or bowel symptoms, including incontinence, urinary urgency, urinary hesitancy, possible constipation, as well as some sexual dysfunctioning, which disabling fatigue. They could have emotional liability, depression, cognitive impairment, slurred speech, dysphagia, dizziness, vertigo, neuropathy, pain, and even more. So the intensity of these symptoms basically is determined by the size of the region of demyelination. So it generally is chronic and will have progressive deterioration, and they will go through periods of remissions and exacerbation. So they'll have time when they're really sick, and then they'll have a time when they're feeling better and their body isn't experiencing as many symptoms. With repeated exacerbations, however, progressive scarring of the myelin sheath occurs, and overall trend is progressive deterioration in neurologic function. If we turn to the next slide, slide 62, it talks about the subtypes of MS, relapsing remitting, primary progressive, secondary progressive, and progression relapsing. And I do not feel like you need to know the specific information about these different subtypes because they all just kind of progress in a different manner, but they all progress as well. So that's what you need to know about that. There is a table in your textbook that talks about these if you'd like to look at more information. Some of the common signs and symptoms, again, I just read through those, so you can read through these on your own. But the average life expectancy after the onset of symptoms is more than 25 years. Usually death occurs as a result of an infectious complication like pneumonia or immobility or even just totally unrelated to MS itself. Severe fatigue is present in many MS patients and causes significant disability for some. The fatigue is usually associated with increased energy needs, deconditioning, depression, and some of the side effects of the medications. On the next slide, it talks about bowel and bladder functions that may be impaired. Spastic bladder is accompanied by urinary urgency and frequency and results in dribbling and incontinence. Generally, urinary retention occurs with a flaccid bladder, but urgency and frequency can also occur with this type of lesion as well. Another urinary problem is a combination of the previous two. Urinary problems cannot be adequately diagnosed and treated unless urodynamic studies are done. So just understanding that that can be an issue is all you need to know. Diminished sensation can actually prevent a normal sexual response in both sexes. The emotional effects of chronic illness and loss of self-esteem can also contribute to the loss of a sexual response. Some women with MS who become pregnant experience remission or an improvement in their symptoms during that time of pregnancy. The hormonal changes associated with pregnancy appear to also affect the immune system, so they actually do better when they're pregnant, believe it or not. On the next slide, it talks about more cognitive manifestations. They may have difficulty with short-term memory, information processing, planning, visual perception, and word finding, especially the later in the disease process. They may also have anger, depression, euphoria, just understanding and getting a grasp of what the diagnosis of MS means. General intellect, including long-term memory, conversational skills, and reading comprehension, usually those remain unchanged and intact, though. So it's important for the patient to understand that. How do we diagnose it? The diagnosis of MS is based on clinical presentation supplemented by lab data. So as a rule, we can't diagnose MS on a basis of symptoms or signs or lab tests alone. Rather, we need all three kinds of information. In addition, because the signs and symptoms and tests suggest that MS can also suggest other disorders. So there's no one definitive test that is going to tell us exactly what we need to know. We need to rule out other possibilities. There is a McDonald criteria for the diagnosis of MS. So there are some defining criteria related to clinical attacks and the separation between the attacks of the MS, the signs they experienced, etc. You don't necessarily need to know that, but there is defining criteria that the physician will go with based on their physical symptoms. As well, there are some diagnostic tools that we can use. And these are your MRI, your cerebral CFS, cerebral spinal fluid testing, and also a measurement of visual evoked potential, VEP. Again, that stands for visual evoked potential. All of three of these tests can help confirm a suspected diagnosis of MS, but they themselves are not definitive proof of the disease. So when we look at all of these different tests, we're going to start with the MRI. That one actually can be helpful because sclerotic plaque as small as 3 to 4 millimeters in diameter can be detected anymore with our technology with the MRI. Characteristic white matter lesions scattered throughout the brain or spinal cord are also evident with that scan. So if we look at the cerebral spinal fluid, CSF test, that is actually used to assess immune activity within the central nervous system. So they're going to look for two different things within the CSF, the cerebral spinal fluid. They're going to look for immunoglobulin IgG, which is IgG, the levels and the measurement of oligoclonal Ig bands, or OCBs. So let me repeat that. They're looking for two things. They're looking for the level of immunoglobulin G, which is IgG. They're also looking for oligoclonal IgG bands. Also, that abbreviation is OCBs. These indicate intrathecal production of antibodies. More than 90% of the patients with MS have these OCBs. However, as with MRI scans, other disorders can also produce positive test results, and negative results can also be seen in patients who do have MS. So accordingly, CSF analysis by itself can neither confirm nor rule out MS. So therefore, they'll also do the VEP, which is visual evoked potential test, and this measures how quickly the brain responds to visual stimuli. Therefore, indirectly measures conduction velocity within the optic nerve. In patients with MS, the VEP is delayed, indicating conduction velocity is slowed owing to the demyelination of the optic nerve. However, again with the rest, there are other disorders that can actually cause this. So this is just one of the other things that they're using to help confirm it based on the complete picture, everything put together. All right, let's now talk about drug therapy, medications. Corticosteroids can be used, and when we talk about meds, there are three basic things we want to do. Drugs are used to modify the disease process, treat any acute relapses, and therefore manage symptoms. We have no drugs that are out there that can actually cure MS. So the first ones are listed on the slide, are your corticosteroids. Adrenocorticotropic hormone, ACTH, methylprednisolone, and prednisone are helpful in treating the acute exacerbations of the disease, probably by reducing edema and acute inflammation at the site of the demyelination. However, these drugs do not affect the ultimate outcome or degree of residual neurological impairment from the exacerbation. So they basically are just used to treat the acute relapse at times. We have the next two different medications, the immunosuppressive and the immunomodulators, are actually disease-modifying drugs that can reduce the frequency and severity of relapse. They can reduce the development of brain lesions, decrease future disability, and help maintain adequate life. In addition, they may prevent permanent damage to the axons. However, it's also important to remember that these drugs can only slow the disease process. Again, they do not cure them. So as we're talking about these drugs, it is important to know, you can just kind of look at the names there. They're under immunosuppressants, Amuran, Cytoxan, Novitrone. These are not just used for MS. They can be used with other inflammation disorders within the body, so they may be used as well. Immunomodulators, you have interferon B, interferon B1A and 1B, Compaxone, Anti-Sabri. These are all different modulators that help to modify the disease process that's actually occurring within the body. I want to talk about this treatment. How soon should we really start treating with the immunosuppressants and the immunomodulators? Really, we need to begin as soon as possible after relapsing and remitting MS has been diagnosed. Why do we do that? Because early treatment can prevent axonal injury and may thereby prevent permanent neurologic deficits. And once this has been started, the treatment should be continued indefinitely. The principal reasons for stopping would be toxicity or if they weren't effective at all. Unfortunately, if disease-modifying therapy is stopped, disease progression may return to the pretreatment rate so it can continue on. So we're really going to try to find one of these drugs to help and be successful in slowing the disease process down. In addition to those medications, they may try other drugs. Muscle relaxants, again, are used for spasticity. Simitrel and other CNS stimulants, Sylert, Ritalin, and Provigil are used to treat any fatigue that the patient might have. Anticholinergics are used to treat any bladder symptoms. Aricept is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, and it's used to treat any cognitive impairment. And tricyclic antidepressants and anti-seizure drugs are basically used for chronic pain syndromes that patients experience with MS. Surgery itself can be done. Again, not a first-line treatment. They're going to think of other things first. They can do a neurectomy, rhizotomy, chordotomy. Those are all ones that are listed. Again, you don't need to specifically know about the specific surgeries. Just know that that is an option. They can do dorsal column, electrical stim. Electrical stim has been proven to help change or divert those changes in neural activity within that dorsal column. And it can help reduce the excess stimulation to that area. They can have an intrathecal baclofen pump. Baclofen is actually a muscle relaxant, so they can actually have that implanted in the intrathecal area, and so it can deliver a constant dose of muscle relaxant, which has been helpful, especially in the later stages of MS. Maintaining physical therapy and as much physical movement as possible is going to be one of the best things they can do. So these therapies, again, are basically to treat the spasticity or of the muscles. Tremors can actually become unmanageable with the medications and are sometimes treated with, again, that deep brain stimulation, but as well as the rest of the things we have listed here. Exercise improves daily functioning for patients with MS who are not experiencing any exacerbation. And one of the things that they have found most benefit for working with patients, especially once in the later stages and they have trouble with their movement and coordination, is actually water therapy. And there's a picture of that on the next page. Water therapy provides exercise and recreation for patients with chronic neurological disease. So the water gives buoyancy to the body and allows the patient to perform activities that would normally be impossible because it gives the patient greater control over their body and their weight becomes different and they're able to then move and exercise in ways they couldn't before. So it's pretty cool that they're doing that. Nutritional therapy for MS, really they're going to give a multivitamin, but the main thing is to eat a healthy diet. There really is no research that proves one thing is better than another for nutritional therapy, so encourage a nutritious, well-balanced diet. And prevention of constipation as well will be important because of their impaired mobility. When we're talking about nursing assessment, again, we're just going to kind of rethink through MS here, subjective and objective data. There's a table in your textbook, 5916, that helps you put some of those pieces together. Nursing diagnosis, one of the biggest ones, impaired physical mobility, dressing, grooming, self-care deficit, risk for impaired skin integrity, impaired urinary elimination, sexual dysfunction, interrupted family processes. So what we need to do when we're providing care is just keep them as functionally active as possible. Maintain independence and activities for as long as possible. Keep their psychosocially, we need to think about how we can maintain their self-esteem and their importance within the community and the role in which they're working within their family. We also need to help them decrease factors that precipitate exacerbations, help them understand what those are, and to recognize when they are having an exacerbation. Exacerbations of MS are generally, they're triggered by infection, especially any upper respiratory or urinary tract infection, trauma, immunizations. After they deliver the baby, pregnancy can be a great thing, but you do have to deliver that baby, and delivering that baby can actually put that mom into a into an exacerbation state. Stress and actually changes in climate can also bring on an exacerbation. So, and each person responds to these triggers differently, so we need to just understand, help our patients understand what those are so they can figure out which ones are affecting them. Patients should know their treatment regimens, the side effect of their medications, and what to watch for, and any drug interactions with over-the-counter medications. So we need to make sure that we are teaching the patient all about the proper care that they need, the good nutrition, how to maintain their body, whether it's elimination patterns or functional musculoskeletal movement. Whatever we can do to help them maintain as much independence as possible is what we need to focus on. All right, the last slide for musculoskeletal is a rest stop. So let's read the question in here for a second, then I'll let you think about the answer. Interferon B has been prescribed for a young woman who has been diagnosed with relapsing remittent multiple sclerosis. The nurse determines that additional teaching about the drug is needed when the patient says, and I'll let you read through those here for a second. The correct answer is number 4. The question asks, the nurse determines the additional teaching about the drug is needed when the patient says. So we just need to understand that interferon B is actually an immunomodulator drug. It is not a corticosteroid. So that statement itself tells the nurse that she hasn't taught appropriately about the drug regimen. So the drug is given sub-Q every other day. Patient teaching should include the following: rotate injection sites with each dose, assess for depression and suicidal ideation, wear sunscreen and protective clothing while exposed to the sun, and know that flu-like symptoms are common following initiation of therapy. So the rest of those are all okay. Number 4 is the one that should stand out to us. And that ends our discussion on MS. If you have any questions, please ask.